From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokot. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina's State Transportation Department overspent by nearly $750 million in a single year. You'll learn details from the state auditor and hear reaction from lawmakers. Legislators also continue their search for ways to help more businesses reopen from Governor Roy Cooper's economic shutdown. We'll have details. Before COVID-19 struck the United States, two North Carolina congressmen were trying to highlight the victims of government sanctuary city policies. You'll hear their concerns. And you'll learn why one expert believes the governor's recent approach to the state budget is reckless and irresponsible. Those topics are just ahead. But first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
In 2019, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services awarded multi-billion-dollar Medicaid managed care contracts to four private companies. These companies scored highest on an evaluation. But now there are questions about whether the agency actually put its thumb on the scale in favor of one company and against another. This whole question is the subject of a really interesting piece written by my next guest. He is Dr. Don Vandervaart. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. You can read this piece at johnlocke.org. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So what you've written about apparently is serious enough that this has ended up in court. Tell us who is suing whom.
Aetna Insurance Company bid for some of these contracts and lost. And they, for various reasons, believe that the process was in some way arbitrary and capricious and filed suit against DHHS for review. And so now they're, as the Administrative Procedure Act requires, they are in the Office of Administrative Hearings right now.
These contracts, Don, just briefly explain what they are and why it is either lucrative enough or influential enough to have one that someone would actually sue over not getting one.
Well, very briefly, for many, many, many years, North Carolina was one of the last remaining states to implement Medicaid through a fee-for-service model. Most other states by far had gone over to a managed care model, which we're pretty much all familiar with. And so in 2015, actually Adelma Voss under the McCrory administration pushed to get this moved over to a managed care model. There are two things that are important. One is that the amount of the contracts are large, very large. This is the largest contract set of contracts that the state has ever let to private companies, $30 billion over 5 years. But number two, they probably are very lucrative because the companies realize that they are starting as a baseline with the historical fee-for-service expenditures of the past years. They believe through their experience that they're going to be able to save a significant amount of money under the managed care model. And it's this difference that they're going to be able to keep, or at least part of, as profit. So it is extremely lucrative, probably. And these insurance companies are looking at a contract, since they were going to award four, they were looking at a contract of around $6 billion over 5 years.
Wow. So that's a huge business opportunity. And for Aetna, which was not selected as one of the four, that is a big loss to the
huge
company.
Tell
us how these four firms were selected. We were told that this was an independent evaluation and that each of the companies were scored, essentially, on certain parameters, and that Aetna simply didn't make the top four.
Right. So DHHS developed an evaluation team, and these there were some seven members, and they were made up of DHHS individuals, but they all had expertise in this area. They met many times to evaluate the proposals from a number of, I think, seven or eight different companies. And they scored them along a long range of criteria, and that's how they were going to develop the winners. The top four were going to be winners.
Now, is it fair to say that Aetna thought that they were going to be the fourth firm selected, but in the end, it ended up that they were scored as number five, and a different firm became number four, and therefore got a contract?
Actually, the results came out and Aetna lost for a number of reasons. They believed that there was perhaps some conflict of interests between some of the members at DHHS and the firm that one of the firms that ended up winning. So they filed suit.
So, Don, it's interesting because folks listening to us might say, well, you know, I mean, sometimes you win a contract, sometimes you don't. That's just the way business goes. And, well, Aetna should just accept that and move on and try to get other business. But something came out in these proceedings over this case that was pretty unexpected and got Aetna's attention.
Well, here's the really bizarre thing. First of all, they filed suit based on what they believed were some conflict of interest, personnel conflicts of interest. So they filed suit. Then they began the discovery process, which is the first part of a fact-finding part of the litigation. And during discovery, nothing more was found. But they continued to have, for example, relationships between members of the DHHS team and this one firm, Blue Cross Blue Shield. So during discovery, nothing more much came out, but then they started to depose some of the DHHS employees, and that's where there was a real surprise. So during one of the depositions where these witnesses are essentially questioned under oath, it came out that at the end of the process, the review process by the evaluation committee, Aetna had actually been scored in the top four. In other words, they were one of the winners. And that document was not revealed to Aetna during normal discovery.
Now, isn't that an ethical breach? I mean, if you watch Law and Order, you kind of know about discovery, and attorneys are required to turn over materials to the opposing side, no?
That's exactly right. And you can understand from a judicial efficiency standpoint that the court wants to get all of the facts out between the two parties. And maybe after all that's done, one party says, nah, you're right. You probably did the right thing. And so when you have the possibility of attorneys concealing information, that's one of the ethical requirements. You don't do that because you want to have both sides have all of the facts before them, before the court spends their time adjudicating. And in this case, you know, if you're talking about if you're Aetna, put yourself in Aetna's shoes. You're Aetna, and you believe for other reasons that you were treated unfairly, okay? I think probably a very important document to you might be a earlier draft final list, really, showing that you were a winner, but then ultimately you were not. And so that list is particularly important to Aetna.
So, Don, what does the state say about this? I mean, do they... They must dispute that Aetna actually was scored higher than Blue Cross, because at the bottom line here, it ends up that Blue Cross is one of the four firms that got the contract and Aetna did not.
Apparently, there was this list developed by the evaluation team showing Aetna was one of the four winners and Blue Cross Blue Shield was not. And then there was an outside senior leadership discussion. and the deputy general counsel stepped in and changed an evaluation parameter. And then Aetna lost.
So, Don, where does this go from here?
Well, right now, the state is actually fighting Aetna's right to include this document in their complaint.
Don Vandervaart has been writing about it. He's senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Don, thanks so much for joining us to talk about it. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokot. North Carolina's State Transportation Department overspent nearly $750 million last year. State Auditor Beth Wood made that determination recently. Wood shared details of her audit with state lawmakers. Republican Senator Tom McInnes set the stage for Wood's remarks.
We've seen, of course, ups and downs in the economy and that sort of thing, and we find ourselves now in a down economy, but it's been exacerbated by issues that have taken place under the management of DOT that through storms and MAP Act and litigation and many other things that have all coincided at one time. We're very, very pleased that the auditor has done the audit, but we're also here to work towards an end result in a bipartisan way to make sure that this doesn't happen again. We've got a work cut out for us. We've got work to do.
Wood went through the numbers, then offered ideas for improving the Transportation Department's spending plan.
We're recommending that the spending plan should be based on cost estimates of specific projects and operations. The Chief Engineer's Office should formally monitor each highway spending on a regular basis and adjust whether those adjustments are holding back or slowing down some of the spending. But there should be some adjustments made. And again, the idea of the disaster spending, we spent $300 million to replace roads destroyed by the hurricane, yet no slowing down for the rest of the year actually happened. The Chief Engineer's Office should take corrective actions whenever highway divisions are overspending, and the Chief Engineer should consider requiring corrections on a quarterly basis.
Senator Jim Davis started the questioning of State Auditor Beth Wood.
There are a lot of pieces to this puzzle. There are a lot of variables to this cash and financial crisis. What is the most meaningful thing that you think that we can recommend that would assist in getting a handle on this financial crisis at DOT?
You got to know where you are. You got to know what your starting point is. And there's got to be some kind of check and balance, some kind of oversight to ensure that that spending plan is being followed like it should be. How they forecasted was not based on projects that are being done, so their forecasting is not what it should be. And then the oversight, once the spending and the cash flow got into trouble, so between the two, better forecasting and then the oversight.
Senator Tom McInnes peppered Wood with a series of questions about the Transportation Department's overspending.
DOT has recently made a public announcement of rolling furloughs that it plans to enact due to its financial situation. In their letter to the General Assembly this week, DOT said the attached plan is necessary to reduce expenditures in this fiscal year to offset the negative impacts of COVID-19 on revenue. It seems that DOT continues to not take responsibility for the mishandling of contracts and are attempting to use the COVID crisis as their excuse for their financial situation. This is nothing new, as DOT has attempted to use natural disasters and the MAP Act payment as an excuse for their spending mismanagement from the time this was made public. My question is, while COVID contributed to DOT's financial situation and recent actions, some of which were actually being implemented before COVID, do you believe DOT's cash management is a strong contributing factor to the poor financial situation we see in the agency today?
Based on the audit that we did, absolutely.
Would you go as far to say that you believe it is more of a contributing factor than the revenue hit due to COVID thus far?
No, the COVID hit thus far, I mean, that's billions of dollars. But certainly that's the time when you should be managing absolutely the best you can, because had they stuck to their spending plan in 2019, DOT would have $700 million more money in the bank.
Do you believe that DOT is using the COVID virus to cover up a pre-existing issue they faced with their cash balance?
I can't answer that question. I don't know.
Do you believe DOT is still not taking proper responsibility for its cash management faults that have come to light in this audit?
According to their response, it appears that they are making that move, and they do have a new secretary, and he has yet to have a chance to see what he can accomplish. I received no pushback at all from him on the findings that we had, and certainly he's brand new. I guess that's some thought that there was a move to the old's out, new's in. So it's hard to say when he hasn't had a chance to do anything yet.
In your audit, did you find that the chief operating officer attempted to slow down or correct the spending rate for which the Office of Chief Engineer was approving?
Based on the audit that we did, no.
Senator Danny Britt continued the questioning of State Auditor Beth Wood. The goal, to get to the root of nearly $750 million in overspending at the State Transportation Department.
DOT did have the ability to slow down or stop the letting of contracts. Is that right?
Some of it makes sense in that if you have a bridge that's half finished, then you certainly couldn't stop. So the idea is that the slowing down or the stopping would be at certain milestones. So given that example, I understand that's part of the reason they said they didn't. But again, you can't spend money you don't have.
But again, there were other projects that they didn't stop or slow down that weren't in that process, is the hypothetical you gave. Is that right?
That could be true, yes.
Was there any point where you determined that the Department of Transportation took any type of corrective action to try to slow the spending?
No, we didn't see any evidence in our work.
Do you believe that upper management were told to keep spending, that the General Assembly would possibly bail them out?
We have no knowledge of that conversation, nor did it come up in our audit.
Wood said her audit suggests that other DOT issues ought to be addressed. Senator Britt wanted to hear about those issues.
What are some of those other things, Madam Auditor, you think need to be looked into?
Well, some of the contracting processes, and I mean, you just have to wonder, if you have preliminary engineering contracts and the spending is $194 million over budget, you believe that the preliminary engineering should be associated with certain projects. I mean, you just have to look into why and how that went on. And then again, the $4.8 billion, and it's just a balance of projects that are anticipated to be paid for with federal monies. Again, what's really in that number?
At what point did DOT appear to realize that there was a spending problem or a cash balance issue?
Again, we were told that in November of 2018, in their cash projections, they recognized that there would be some problems in their cash projections, November 2018.
So most of these problems they recognized within almost 2 years ago, not since COVID-19. Is that right?
That would be true.
Was there any information that the governor was aware of the problems at DOT, and how long ago was he made aware of the problems at DOT?
I have no idea.
That's State Auditor Beth Wood responding to a series of questions from State Senator Danny Britt. Britt was one of multiple members of the Senate's Transportation Committee asking questions about a recent state audit. It found that the North Carolina Transportation Department overspent nearly $750 million last year. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina restaurants reopened in the COVID-19 pandemic at just 50% capacity. Some state lawmakers want to compensate by permitting more outdoor dining. Republican Senator Rick Gunn.
It's been an amazing amount of response for House Bill 536, which will hopefully be a lifeline for our restaurants as we all work through this very, very tough time.
Gunn amended his original plan.
We are allowing a designated area. We felt it would be important to one of those designated areas can in fact be a temporary tent. So we describe a little bit more specific what a temporary tent is. It was a little bit of concern for some folks that they did not want this continue indefinitely by the city. So we've got a hard closure that will occur either October 31st, 2020, or when the executive orders are lifted, whichever is later.
Gunn is targeting more than restaurants.
This will allow the private clubs, private bars, wineries, breweries, and distilleries to do pretty much what the restaurants can do. The same dates, effective dates, will be there. These entities, these job creators, these small business entrepreneurs trying to make a tough go of it and need our help. And they thank you, and I thank you in advance for your support. You're changing the lives of potentially 350,000 plus individuals in our state and the businesses that hire them.
Democratic Senator Sam Searcy responded.
I spoke with the mayors of Apex, Holly Springs, and Cary just before this committee meeting, and they are overwhelmingly in favor of this bill and getting people back to work. One question that was posed to me, and I assume it's pretty logical, will we be using plastic rather than glass, obviously, if it's outdoor facilities, or would that be something left to the municipalities?
If I understand, the restaurant and lodging folks have been working tirelessly with DHHS and the health department, and they'll be using their guidelines as it comes to best practices.
Republican Senator Jim Perry thanked Gunn.
I think you are correct. We have a lot of families and a lot of lives who have been disruptive. And the cash flow of these restaurants is just in a really precarious place. And this is going to be very helpful. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Committee Chairman John Alexander reminded colleagues the change will come too late for some.
I read the other day that Vivian Howard is going to be closing her oyster bar permanently. That's sad. She's a great restaurateur and a citizen of our state.
You've been listening to legislators discuss measures to help North Carolina restaurants and bars recovering from COVID-19. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A couple of North Carolina congressmen are drawing national attention to the issue of sanctuary cities. During a recent speech on Capitol Hill, Republican Representative Ted Budd of the 13th District explained his efforts to hold those cities accountable for their actions.
Sanctuary city policies threaten the safety of American citizens. And I want to commend the Trump administration for its crackdown on sanctuary cities, and I applaud the recent Second Circuit of Appeals decision allowing the Department of Justice to withhold funding from sanctuary cities. Now, back in June, Immigration and Customs Enforcement released a list of criminal illegal aliens that were allowed back into their sanctuary communities by local officials. One such criminal is Rosario Ramos Romas. He's a Honduran citizen who was deported four times before authorities arrested him in Washington State in October of 2017. Once notified of Rosario's arrest, ICE issued a written detainer request asking the local authorities to imprison him for an additional 48 hours so that they could decide whether or not to begin deportation proceedings. Instead, local authorities ignored the detainer request and released Rosario back into the community. In January of 2018, he murdered his cousin, and then he hid the body in a dumpster. In another instance in 2015, Garcia Zarate, an illegal immigrant from Mexico, shot and killed 32-year-old Kate Steinle, a very well-known case and a tragedy, while she was walking with her father and her friend on Pier 14 in San Francisco. Prior to the shooting, Garcia Zarate had been deported five times and was supposed to be deported for a sixth time. He had been transferred to San Francisco's jail to serve a sentence for selling marijuana, but local authorities released him a few days later despite a detainer request from federal law enforcement. Situations like these are more common than they should be in our country, and many local officials protect illegal immigrants and ignore federal immigration laws up to the point of leaving dangerous individuals in their communities. As you can see from these horrific examples, refusing to honor detainer requests and frustrating local law enforcement has dire consequences. Not only does it make our nation less safe, it leaves no room for the victims of these offenders to obtain justice.
Bud has a response to the problem.
That's why I introduced the Justice for Victims of Sanctuary Cities Act, along with my colleague, Representative Bradley Byrne, here in the House, and my fellow North Carolinian Tom Tillis over in the Senate. This legislation would allow anyone who is a victim of murder, rape, or any felony to file a lawsuit and bring civil action against the state or the sanctuary city if that city failed to honor a lawful immigration detainer request from the Department of Homeland Security. Any individual who is injured or harmed by an illegal immigrant who benefited from sanctuary city's policy will be able to sue the sanctuary city or state. My bill also requires sanctuary cities to waive a criminal's immunity as a condition of receiving certain federal grants. If the jurisdiction doesn't agree to waive immunity, it will not be eligible for grants, public works, grant planning, and administrative expenses, and grants for training, research, and technical assistance.
Bud says the proposal has some high-profile support.
I'm extremely proud that President Trump endorsed our bill during his 2020 State of the Union address. It's time for Congress to force sanctuary cities to comply with federal law enforcement and to stop them from letting dangerous criminals remain on our streets. It's finally time to give victims of sanctuary city policies a legal pathway to justice.
Bud got a firsthand look at why his proposal is necessary.
During my trip to the southern border last year, I witnessed the humanitarian and security crisis up close and personal. I saw the sorry state of some areas of our border. I saw places that were only defended by thin barbed wire fences. These weak defenses allow practically anyone to break into our country, and that includes dangerous members of drug cartels who fuel our country's devastating opioid crisis.
Bud has support for his idea from fellow Republican Dan Bishop. He represents North Carolina's 9th congressional district.
From San Francisco to my district in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, cities across the country are declaring themselves sanctuary cities. The term sounds peaceful, but the results are exactly the opposite. North Carolina sheriffs in a few urban counties released over 500 illegal aliens last year who were convicted or accused of serious crimes, including domestic violence, indecency with a child, even rape and murder. Rather than hand over these vicious criminals to federal authorities, sanctuary cities and counties release them into your community to prey on you and your family.
Bishop doesn't understand why cities and counties take those actions.
What is the purpose of this policy? Clearly, it is not public safety, nor is it for the protection of immigrant communities. Indeed, they are the most victimized by these predators. Rather, it is meant to serve a national liberal agenda that prizes open borders over community safety. Across the nation, we were horrified to learn last year about a 92-year-old woman brutally raped and murdered at the hands of an individual who should have never been released, whom ICE asked to hold. So, the increasing breakdown in the relationship between federal and local authorities isn't just theoretically dangerous. Sanctuary policies put dedicated law enforcement officers at risk.
Bishop explains what happens when local authorities refuse to work with federal immigration officials.
When criminals are released despite an ICE detainer, ICE has a statutory responsibility to collect them. Rather than have a secure transfer, ICE must go into the community to track down the individual for an uncontrolled arrest. Ironically, if the situation turns violent, the very local police who arrested the alien the first time will be there to back up ICE.
Bishop explains his support for his colleague Ted Budd's proposal.
To hold these jurisdictions to account, I was proud to sign on to the Justice for Victims of Sanctuary Cities Act, which would allow victims of crimes committed by individuals released under sanctuary city policies, or their survivors, to sue sanctuary jurisdictions. For example, in the New York City case, the woman's family would be able to sue the local government for allowing the release of her killer, who should have been safely in ICE custody. Often, cities and towns claim immunity from being sued like this, denying victims' rights. The bill would allow communities to maintain that practice, but not at the expense of American taxpayers.
Bishop responds to critics.
I've heard across the aisle that sanctuary cities only release individuals who pose no community harm. If you believe that, you should have no issue with this bill, because those who are released won't endanger the community, and no one would ever be enabled to sue. I, however, believe we must take this threat seriously and impose concrete costs to communities who refuse to follow the law.
That's U.S. Representative Dan Bishop, Republican from North Carolina's 9th District. Along with his 13th District colleague Ted Budd, he spoke recently on Capitol Hill in favor of the Justice for Victims of Sanctuary Cities Act. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Reckless and irresponsible, that is the description applied to Governor Roy Cooper's plan for state spending, despite the crushing impact of COVID-19 on North Carolinians who pay the taxes, thousands of whom have been put out of work by the governor's statewide shutdown order. Joe Coletti is senior fellow for the John Locke Foundation. He authored the analysis of the governor's spending plan, joins us now to talk about what is inside that plan. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, give us a sense of how COVID-19 has impacted the state in terms of revenues and services that the state had anticipated providing.
Yeah, so the first impact and why the governor needs to act on this is that it reduced the income tax that we're able to receive and the sales and use tax that the state receives. The income tax, because with the shutdown of activity, both voluntary and then state mandated, people were losing jobs. And then you had the federal government delay income tax deadlines and for filing and for paying, and the state followed suit. So instead of getting that money in April, it's now in July. So that had a huge impact on income tax as well. And then the sales tax fell also as a result of the closures and the not going out of folks.
So yeah, stores there's
no,
aren't open.
No sales, no restaurants, yeah. No, right. And there's only so much you can buy off Amazon. So
I don't know about that. I may have a personal testimony there, but that's another show.
but those two things, the loss of sales tax revenue and the loss of income tax revenue hurt the state's bottom line. We still don't know what the full impact of that is, but we know that March, April, and May have been significantly down as a result. Then because you have the additional need and more people are out of work, and with school shut down, you have increasing expenses for K-12 schools and for universities about making the transition to distance learning. You have other, more Medicaid potential spending and more healthcare potential spending. And with outbreaks in nursing homes and in prisons, you have more spending going in those directions. So there's a lot of additional money that needs to be spent. And so and you're doing that at a time that revenues are falling, and it only makes sense for the governor to start reeling back the spending that is already happening. And it took him a long time to start doing that.
Joe, it sounds like a really ugly fiscal picture, right, frankly, you know, and the whole the medical aspect of COVID-19 aside, we won't talk about that in this interview. But fiscally, this is just really ugly. So as you mentioned, one would think based on all of this, you know, increasing demands for needs, less revenue that will be coming in, that the chief executive of the state would be putting together a plan that would be reining in spending, right, paring back exactly what it is that the state can do. Apparently, that's not what Governor Cooper is doing, though.
Not nearly to the extent that other governors have done in the past. So it took from the time that he issued the stay-at-home order on March 17th on St. Patrick's Day until the end of April to say, this, we're going to take some steps to start peeling back spending. And the first of those is it was a travel freeze. Well, that made sense. That was kind of already happening, right? Because
right,
nobody's
can't
going
go out of your
right
house.
But put a limit on hiring, put a limit on salary increases and on contracts that were already in place. So reducing purchases, and most of that all makes sense. But Governor Perdue and Governor Easley, 10 years ago and 20 years ago, when faced with similar large revenue shortfalls that we're anticipating this time, 6.6% this year, 9.9% next year. So a total of $4.2 billion between the two fiscal years. When they had similar reductions in revenue, they both told agencies, send back money. Those are called reversions. At the end of the year, we need to have some money back from you. They told them to implement savings plans and looking for 5 to 7% spending reductions. In addition to the freezes on hiring, on salaries, on travel, on other purchases.
And Governor Cooper hasn't done this?
Has not done that. And that's where he gets a reckless and irresponsible is that, the state started off in relatively good shape because the governor was asking for way too much, there was capital that both he and the General Assembly wanted. He wanted higher teacher raises than the General Assembly wanted. And because they couldn't come to an agreement on those things, that money has not been spent. And so we're fortunate to have that available. But even with the money that's unspent and attached to the savings reserve, that's barely going to get us through the anticipated revenue shortfall for the next year. And that doesn't even count the potential for a major storm in the area, which the last one cost us $750 million out of the rainy day fund, and doesn't count the spending that's been going on at NCDOT that has raised the condemnation of the state auditor.
Joe, with this situation looming, one would think that unusual steps, very serious steps, would have to be taken because it's such an unusual situation. We've also heard the phrase share the pain bandied about a lot by the governor's administration, and understandably so. Unprecedented times, we all understand that. But is there any way that we can reasonably expect to go forward, knowing we're in the situation that we are in, without making some serious cuts, at the very least, to spending growth, right, if not actual spending? I mean, isn't that what share the pain is all about? State government having to buy into that as well?
That's usually what everybody is part of the sharing. Yeah. And one of the things that Governor both Perdue and Easley did was they said, when you're making these reductions, make them long term. Look for recurring reductions. So they were looking for, how do you change the way state government operates so that state government can be stronger on the other side of it than it was coming into it? And when you're doing the temporary reductions that Governor Cooper is asking for, and not asking for those significant savings, not only are you raising the likelihood that you're going to have to go back to the state citizens and raise what is likely going to be the sales tax, because that's what gets you revenue quickly. This is it is not good budgeting and is not wise budgeting.
If we are going to follow the governor's course on this, then doesn't that simply require tax increases, whether it's a sales tax or income tax? And politically, would that mean the governor would have to hope for very good news for Democrats in the fall election? What about the impact on individual North Carolinians, many of whom are out of a job, some people working part-time because they're old job is still mandated out of existence. I mean, it just seems like, you know, a terrible concoction to go forward.
Yeah. And the governor is waiting for and hoping that by putting these things off, that eventually we will get a second round of federal money for the state and for local governments. That's what the News and Observer and Charlotte Observer both asked for in their editorials earlier this week. And that's what his statements and the memos that to agencies have said is that we're going to wait for federal certainty, which means both flexibility, which we've called for, and more money on top of that. So that's the danger.
But
that's
the problem is, of course, federal tax dollars come from the very same people in North Carolina who also pay state tax dollars. So that doesn't seem like much of a solution.
It's a bad situation that we're in. Either higher taxes now or higher taxes later because the federal government is taking on additional deficits and debt.
Joe Coletti, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.